Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Emmanuel Centre and to this spectator debate on Brexit, deal or no deal. It's pretty remarkable that, first off, we're meeting on budget night and nobody, including Ken Clark, wants to talk about the budget. We didn't miss very much. But also, we should have a political debate and find queues snaking down Marsham Street. We've sold out a 1,000-seat venue to come here to talk about politics, but with what a panel. We have tonight a former Chancellor, Ken Clark, a former Brexit Secretary, David Davis, the former Chairman of Leave Campaign, Gisela Stewart, the author of the best book on Brexit, Liam Halligan, and the best political journalist in London, James Forsyth. Please join me in welcoming them to the stage. Now, technically our panelists are supposed to give a 5-minute speech, but they said back in the green room there that that would mean 25 minutes and there was too much to discuss, so we'd rather get stuck into it. So I'm going to start asking questions, then we're going to throw it open to you guys, because I'm sure all of you have got questions to ask. So I guess, David Davis, my first goes to you. There is not much optimism of getting a good Brexit deal. In Cabinet last week, even Philip Hammond was saying that this would not be good, it would just be better than the alternative. The Prime Minister says there's a bad deal is better than no deal, but it's difficult to work out, isn't it, how bad a bad deal has to get to qualify as a bad deal.
I think we've shown it already.
Right. But the thing is, there is the feeling that because you lot are also terrified of no deal, that you will back a deal no matter how bad.
Yeah, well, that's not true. I mean, 2 years ago, I said to people like you and many other journalists, this will only become important in the last 2 months in terms of the actual progress in negotiation because both sides are excessively terrified of no deal. They're absolutely paralyzed by it. And that's what will force the movement in a negotiation. Now, the danger in this is that the government thinks that we're all so terrified of no deal that we'll take anything else in exchange. And I think then, in some ways, that's the genesis of Chequers. And there are plenty of people on my side of the argument who think Chequers is as bad as, or if not worse, than actual membership, because it's all the rules of membership with none of the control. So I think you're right that it's a difficult time, but I think the fear of the alternative will drive both the government and the European Commission to a constructive outcome.
Right, so you're saying that you think that a good deal will emerge right at the last moment, but I put it to you that you yourself are really quite nervous about the prospect of no deal, because you know from the job you did that the preparations simply have not been made for no deal.
No, some of the preparations were delayed. There are about 300 projects to deal with deal, no deal, intermediate deal, and so on. And of them, about 120 or so are very important. Some of them depend either on third countries, treaties, and some of them depend on companies preparing, right? Now, what should have happened in March of this year was that we should have put that in the public domain and said to the companies, you know, you've got to do the following things to deal with customs. Unfortunately, the Treasury and Number 10 got nervous at that point because we were just introducing the implementation period. We just told the businesses, we've got the implementation period. You've got 21 months to prepare. Be happy. And the Treasury and Number 10 didn't like the idea of their, at the same time saying, but while you're being happy, just prepare for the other outcome, would you? And so it got delayed. So there are about, there's about 6 months of delay introduced into the system, but it's all still manageable. They have to do it much faster. And the thing that people really worry about is not our preparation. They're terrified that the French or somebody will hold deliberately cause problems. Well, that actually, that story was sunk last week. Because Xavier Bertrand, who's a man who runs northern France, Haute France, which includes Calais and all the other ports, said, we don't want to do that. We and there's evidence on the ground. They've recruited customs personnel. They've identified two locations outside Calais to do the animal inspections. They've introduced a fast track or fast pass system to accelerate things. They've agreed to cut the inspection rate so things can go through fast. Why are they doing all that? They're doing all that for two reasons. Number one is if they block up Dover to Calais, they block up Calais to Dover. They wreck their own economy. The second reason is, from our point of view, if they do that, we can move, depending on the type of traffic, between 20 and 40% of the traffic to other ports, to go to Zeebrugge, or to go to Antwerp, or to go to Rotterdam. So actually, the only people to lose by that option will be the French themselves. Bertrand understands it more than Macron does, and at the end of the day, it'll be the regional politician, not the national politicians, who win that argument.
Okay. Now, James, can you talk to us a bit about what the... your political column last week, you wrote that a lot of people in the cabinet are now really worried that Theresa May is going to come back from Brussels with a bad deal. Can you describe what that would look like? What are we talking about in terms of what she'll have promised in exchange for what exactly?
So their worry is that in December, Theresa May agreed to this backstop for the Northern Irish border. When the real mistake was that the UK government made no effort to turn that agreement into a legal text. The EU then emerged with a legal text that would see Northern Ireland remain in the customs territory of the European Union if the UK diverged from EU rules, and see Northern Ireland continuing to follow single market rule in a whole host of areas while the rest of the UK did not. Theresa May immediately declared that no British Prime Minister could ever sign this document because it would divide up the UK. But her response to the hole that she was in was to essentially try and dig a hole big enough for the entirety of the UK. To essentially turn around to the DUP and say, don't worry, we're all going to be in the same boat. And this is this UK-wide backstop. What worries members of the Cabinet is that the UK would go into this backstop with no end date and no clear legally binding exit mechanism. And what they worry about is that, as one of them explained it to me, it would be like negotiating to sell your house to somebody having said to them that they can move in and live there, rent-free, but hopefully they could come to an agreement on the price at a later date. And essentially the thing is the UK would have paid the money, one major point of negotiating leverage, and would be in a customs union with the EU, which would ensure that EU firms would continue to have preferential access to the UK market. And, added bonus for the EU here, that they could offer up access to the UK market to any other international competitor without the say-so of the UK. And so this is what the Cabinet fears is a bad deal. But I think members of the Cabinet are also very worried about no deal. I listened to what David was saying about the French regional government and all this, but I think one of the things that Cabinet ministers feel that they've learned in this negotiation is that the EU is prepared to pay an economic price to prove the political point that if you leave the EU, there are consequences. And so what they worry about is that whatever pain it might impose upon the French economy, they will be prepared to put the UK through 3 weeks, a month, of economic pain of such that it would bring the whole question of competence into play. I mean that whatever happened afterwards, the Tories had lost the election with no deal in the same way that they lost the election with Black Wednesday, despite the economic recovery that followed it.
Right. So, James, the situation there is Theresa May comes back from Brussels, having A, signed away the £40 billion, B, signed away Northern Ireland, three, signed away the sort of customs union and access to it, in exchange for we don't know what in terms of free trade. We might end up paying £40 billion for something the South Koreans got for free. The thing is, Gisela Stuart, I can see why you personally might not vote for that. But if I were Jeremy Corbyn, I might vote for it because this deal would be guaranteed to destroy politically whoever comes after Theresa May. So I can, and I'm wondering what you think the Labour Party's reaction to this, because if she's about to do what James suggests, in other words, give everything away in exchange for not very much, and leave her successor to spend 2 years negotiating the rest of it, that successor isn't going to emerge in a position fit to win an election. So might we get a bad deal voted through against the protests of David here by Jeremy Corbyn because he's sure it's a route for a Labour government?
And that would be looking at this entire question through the wrong spectrum. Ooh. Because this is now about the national interest. This is not about the fortunes of the Tory party or Theresa May and who leads her, or who leads the Labour Party and who will be formed the next government. When you call a national referendum, as we did in 2016, and you make a very significant decision, as we've done in a sequence of referendum about how the British people wish to govern themselves, and they decided they wanted to give more power to Wales, they decided that Scotland should remain part of the United Kingdom, they decided not to change the electoral system, and they decided to leave the European Union. These are significant national decisions. And therefore, my expectations of members of Parliament, and I used to be one for 20 years, is that you then regard it as your primary duty to implement that result. And if we keep going through about this, will it be good for Theresa May, will it be good for Jeremy Corbyn, then there, and at the moment, like saying, oh, well, it is so complicated, you know, we can't come up with a decision, and this is where I can pick a fight with Ken in a moment, but we'll wait for that one. Is to say that at that stage, you as politicians have actually abdicated your responsibility or have shown yourself incapable of fulfilling your job. And that would be seriously, seriously bad for democracy and consequently bad for our economic performance. Because I have this, you may think, rather old-fashioned belief that I think functioning liberal democracies are the fundamental conditions for economic prosperity. And these are fragile creatures. You know, what has shown us in the last few years, or even just the recent elections in Germany, when two big states, the voters turned against the major political parties. If we undermine democratic processes, we will subsequently also undermine democratic economic success, and that would be bad. So forget about Theresa May, forget about Jeremy Corbyn. This is a national decision, and I think we really ought to pull together to get the best deal possible for both sides, actually, Fraser, because it's not going to be in either side's interest to inflict harm either on the leaving country or on the remaining European Union.
Right. Now, as you can see, we have a balanced panel tonight, and that Ken Clark is such a titan that he can take on all the Brexiteers put together.
Thank you. Yeah.
So.
Been doing it for 30 years.
So, Ken, are you still holding out for a second referendum then? I mean, aren't you worried that she's going to come back?
I wasn't in favour of the first. I'm not in favour of the second. I won't take too long on that because we've been talking about where we are now, but I don't see any prospect of reversing it. I fear the political class as a whole is just not going to have the courage to disown the kind of religious quality that's been given to this rather surprising first referendum result. I was never in favour of holding the referendum, didn't vote for the referendum, made it quite clear that I wasn't going to change my lifelong opinions of the national interest because of one opinion poll. I think the campaign was ridiculous. None of the things we're now arguing about got any prominence in the national campaign. They weren't on the national media. It was all about George Osborne saying it would be death and destruction within 3 months on the Remain side. And it was all these millions of Turks coming here to molest our women folk and take our jobs. And all the money that we were going to give to the health service on the other. And now I'm told, when I vote against our leaving Euratom, that my masters, the people, have told me that Britain should leave Euratom. It's arrogant, of course, to suggest, although it's actually just they're busy, sensible, intelligent people, my constituents, many of them more intelligent than me, but they're not interested in Euratom. Some of them don't know what it is. Certainly the politics of nuclear safeguarding are a mystery to them. To load all this difficult negotiation we have at the moment with some assertion made by lots of, because none of the leavers altogether agree with each other, neither do remainers altogether agree with each other, with assertions that your argument is somehow loaded with the will of the people on the single market or whatever, is farcical. And I think history will look back in amazement at what is probably a decisive historic juncture in this country in deciding its role in the world. It was all decided for that, which Cameron called for trivial reasons. And I don't accept that. But let me get to what I think the point is of what we do now. I don't think we're going to stay in the European Union. I regret the Lancaster House speech, which was when suddenly the vote was turned into a decision that we had to leave the single market, we had to leave the customs union, and we couldn't accept the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. None of those things had featured in the campaign particularly. Oh, they hadn't. What's the name of the local MEP? What's the name of the local MEP, by far the best advocate that from the European Parliament of the very Brexit side? Oh, I can't remember his name.
Dan Hannan.
He's as much in favour of the single market as I am. I debated him twice in town hall meetings during the referendum. Dan wasn't advocating leaving the single market and the customs union. What I want to preserve is as much as possible of our privileged position at the moment, where our role in the world politically, if we ever get on to that, is we're one of the three leading players of the EU. That's what keeps us influential sometimes in what we do. But economically, we're one of the leading influential members of the biggest international free trade area in the world, completely without barriers. We trade with our nearest neighbours, who happen to be rich, developed countries. By and large, they're obviously always going to be our major trading partners, because geographics does come into it. The costs of trading with your neighbours are always overwhelming. And we have, I'm a free trader, we have developed the most developed international free trade area the world has so far devised, and we're leaving it. We must minimise the consequences of that. And I want to keep as much of the benefits as we can, although even if fair to where we were before. And then what's holding us up is, forget this conspiracy stuff, the idea that the French and that Jean-Claude Juncker and Barnier are all hostile and trying to punish us. Daily Mail, rubbish. It's important to them as it is to us that we minimise the damage of this dislocation we're causing. All the way through these negotiations, the reason we wasted 2.5 years before getting around to the serious bits in the last few months is the British government cannot agree amongst themselves what it is they're trying to negotiate, and they cannot agree, if they ever do manage to agree amongst themselves, and they haven't so far, they don't think they can get a parliamentary majority for it. So we're waiting for one side of the negotiations to make some progress. What we obviously need, we've got to conclude the withdrawal agreement, which means we must, and here I agree with Theresa May, make sure we're not going to break the Good Friday Agreement, thank you very much. Symbolism in Ireland is very important. That was one of the great achievements of John Major and particularly Tony Blair, the Good Friday Agreement, which we did with the Irish and the Americans. We're going to have a totally open border. You can only have an open border if you don't have tariffs, if you don't have customs procedures, you don't have regulatory compliance both sides of the border, and there's no other way of keeping it. Otherwise, you create a smuggler's paradise. And we signed up once, and the draft withdrawal agreement, we signed up, having the open border and having no regulatory checks. And we've agreed, if you've had, as I believe in the United Kingdom fervently, an open border and our land border with the EU, I would extend to the rest. Well, we have in Ireland, I want to see it in Dover and Holyhead, they were the benefits.
So you'll be very happy then with the way negotiations are going.
Not particularly, because...
Well, you're going to get
we're not, because we put all kinds of funny things in it. We have regulatory compliance, but we won't obey the rules. in future, the British, no one can think of a regulation we want to change. Most of the regulations we have are ones the British insisted on.
But I'm wondering, can you think of a Brexit deal that you would regard as so bad that no deal would be preferable? Can you envisage such
yes,
a situation?
Any deal which involves putting in, you know, training thousands of customs officers, getting the lorry parks at all our ports, introducing all the customs compliance things, so you have to have certificates of origin and so on, and having inspections for that will destroy our role in the global economy, because modern supply chains, I mean, rubbish. My views are shared, but my shares are shared by everybody with any responsible role in car manufacturing in this country, in pharmaceuticals in this country, by the IMF, by the Treasury, by the Bank of England, the CBI, Chambers of Commerce, Institute of Directors, and people say rubbish. Yeah, Boris knows more about these things than those people do. We are running a serious risk of a car crash. We need a long transition, because you won't get any trade agreement in by December 2020, long transition where we stay as we are, have some grown-ups having a negotiation to produce something like the South Koreans in due course, then work out how you're going to change to
obviously
that.
Thank you. And also, and I know Liam Fox, you are in the audience, but don't heckle quite so loudly next time when Ken's speaking. Right? Now, Liam Halligan, you're an economist. You will have seen various scenarios of what no deal would mean. I dare say you think a lot of them are exaggerated, but even you cannot be entirely blasé about the prospect of crashing out of this. So can you talk to us a bit about, let's say, you know, she comes back with a deal that Parliament doesn't vote for, and there's no time, so you decide to switch, I don't know, in November to negotiations on a Brexit deal that doesn't involve trade or something. In other words, it's effectively going to be no deal. We have 2 or 3 months to prepare for it. Economically, how big a hit would we take?
Well, I am an economist, Fraser, so I don't know what I'm talking about. And I'm going to make all of you feel as if that's your fault.
He's giving away the secrets of a trade here tonight.
It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Fraser. I'm delighted to contribute to The Spectator from time to time and be up here debating with some of the leading players in our national debate. But I would say to my friend Ken, and we're always nice to each other when we're on panels, I would say...
And afterwards.
Yeah, and afterwards. I would say, when you look at the referendum results, let's not undermine and underestimate what it does mean. You said sort of near religious. Well, I think it is pretty important. If Parliament votes 6-1, ladies and gentlemen, to give a decision to the British people, and then they make that decision, even if it's what most of the establishment didn't want, and even if it means a lot of people who are used to getting their own way in life didn't get their way on this occasion, if we then gainsay it as a political and media class, and it's kind of lawyered out of existence due to political shenanigans, then I really do believe, even if it's expressed in a responsible way, there will be righteous anger in this country. And I really believe... I'm not going to use the platform I have in various newspapers and television programs and so on to say there'll be civil unrest, ladies and gentlemen. But I do believe that an awful lot of people who voted in that referendum, some of them for the very first time, becoming part of our democracy, and we all want democracy, right? They'll never vote again, and their kids will never vote again. And we will develop, along with our economic underclass, a political underclass that will be extremely difficult to rescue. I would disagree that we didn't talk about the single market and the customs union during the referendum, vehemently. When I last looked, the Treaty of Rome is a customs union. It's the very essence of the European Union, European Economic Community, as was. To think that you can leave the European Union in any meaningful form while staying in a customs union is frankly absurd. It makes you... The only country in that position is Turkey, because it's extremely keen economically to become part of the club, and the EU is interested in exploiting that keenness. So it keeps it in the customs union, but outside the main structure. And to say that we didn't talk about the single market, with all respect, Ken, is also absurd. The phrase "to take back control of our laws, borders, and money" was coined deliberately to capture what the single market is in a soundbite of just a few words. And you know what? When Lancaster House speech was given in January 2017, sterling went up. There was a murmur of approval from around the world and from the EU. The thing the EU fears most of all is us cherry-picking. That's why Chequers isn't a deal, whatever anybody in the cabinet says. It's a proposal that will never be agreed. Lancaster House said we'd be outside the single market and the customs union, and there was not a squeak out of the Remain lobby then, because it was clear that's what it meant, to leave the single market and the customs union. All this stuff about, oh, we can stay in the single market and the customs union, it happened after June 2017. And of course, what happened in June 2017? We all know what happened in June 2017. The Prime Minister was right to call an election, in my view. David and others may disagree, but she obviously fought a ridiculous campaign.
Thank you.
I wasn't going to say.
I'll take credit.
That's the journalist's definition of a secret. You only tell one person at a time. Sorry, Fraser. And what also happened in June 2017, and this is the really important point that Future Hill historians will latch onto, is that a guy that few people in this room knew or had barely heard of called Enda Kenny stopped being the Taoiseach of the Republic of Ireland. And a guy even fewer people had heard of called Leo Varadkar became the Taoiseach. And one was a pragmatic person who realised the role that Ireland would play. And there had been all kinds of cooperation from the referendum up until the middle of 2017 between the Irish and the British authorities to deal with this border issue, and it didn't even figure. So I published a book in July 2017 called Clean Brexit. Yeah, it's on sale outside. And I had a huge row with the publishers, because I am obviously of Irish origin, a lot of family in Ireland, I follow the Irish press very closely. I had a huge row with the publishers, and my extremely distinguished co-author, who is a noted authority on Brexit, that I simply have to write a chapter on Ireland. And my publisher, who, yeah, Ian Dale, one of the top political analysts in this country, and Jerry Lyon said, "Why?" And I said, "I'm not having this book go out with my name on it unless we have a chapter on Ireland." So I literally wrecked my summer holiday. My wife hasn't forgiven me, and wrecked the publishing schedule to write a chapter on Ireland. My point, ladies and gentlemen, as well as a sort of side book plug, is that at this point, Ireland was not an issue. It was only an issue after the political landscape changed, both in the House of Commons and somebody became Taoiseach in the Republic of Ireland who was determined to do a deal with the European Union to lower Ireland's big contributions that are coming in the EU in future years to come. Enda Kenny wasn't going to do that. He thought it was dishonourable, but his successor is doing it. That's precisely what he's trying to do. Lower contributions for Ireland in the future if the island helps EU to stiff the UK. That's what's happening. Now, I do think that there's been tremendous fear-mongering and about no deal. We have to define our terms, though, and our terms should be this. To leave with no deal, to leave without a free trade agreement with the European Union, that is completely fine. That is perfectly manageable. They're not my words, they're the words of the head of the WTO. The world's most senior trade diplomat, in an interview with me, as it happens, over a year ago. We can easily trade under WTO rules with the EU because we trade under those rules with the US. The US trades with China under those rules, China with the EU, the EU with the US. Most trade in the world goes on outside formal free trade agreements. I actually believe if the UK was on WTO rules and the heat of Brexit had passed and the emotion, WTO rules is a fabulous platform from which to negotiate a free trade agreement that will last for years and years to come. If we try and negotiate a free trade agreement up against this Article 50 deadline, that's going to lock in a bad free trade agreement for years and years to come. So I actually think we should use WTO rules as a platform. Separately, though, and James and Fraser and their colleagues at The Spectator have been at the forefront of this, there's the addition. So I don't think WTO rules is a danger, and I don't think the Treasury has got any kind of monopoly on wisdom about this. Let's not talk about the immediate and profound economic shock that was going to hit the UK in August 2016. But then there's separate concerns, and that is that we have a disorderly Brexit where everybody throws their toys up in the air, and we don't manage to agree things like mutual recognition agreements. We don't manage to agree things like arrangements once the UK leaves Europe's air traffic agreements and all the rest of it. And all I'd say about that is, and David's right, very senior people who run Northern France have basically called Macron out in the last week. The idea that Europe's political leaders, particularly a political leader who's got the lowest poll ratings of any of his predecessors in 40 years, you know, nice socks, yes, he's very good looking. Lots of television producers want to meet him. But is he really in a position to impose huge political and economic pain on his own economy at a time when the Bank of France is downgrading growth forecasts, now well below the UK growth, by the way? No, I don't think so. We can talk about it some more, but in the end, let's take aviation. I mean, we are the second biggest civil aviation power in the world. Heathrow is the Europe's civil airline hub. The idea that the likes of Lufthansa and Air France are just going to stand idly by when the UK prevents EU planes from flying over Britain's airspace so they can't go to America, I mean, that's just preposterous. That's preposterous. There will be memorandums of understanding at the last minute to say, yeah, we'll just carry on for now. There's tens and tens of billions of pounds a week are at stake here. I'm not complacent for one second. What I am saying is that there are massive, massive commercial imperatives here, and I think we are starting to see now a lot of the business classes across countries in the EU and in the UK, beyond this kind of huge lobby groups that Ken's spoken about, beyond the car. I mean, the whole point of a car CEO is to hold a gun to a government's head. That's all they do, isn't it? There are many, many business interests now who are concerned, and I think that in the end, we will leave with no deal. I first wrote that in 2 weeks after the referendum. We will leave on WTO rules. I wish we did have a good free trade agreement. I don't think we will get one before March 2019, certainly not one that's agreed and ratified by 27 parliaments, Giva, Hofstadt and Walloon. And I think in the end, when future historians look back, they'll think this was a moment when the political classes had a nervous breakdown, disregarded or were very close to disregarding what the people actually said. And I get a real hard time from a lot of the sort of liberal media establishment for what I write about Brexit. But I'm proud of what I've written, because I think when we look back in a few years' time, the arguments I'm putting forward will bear up well.
Let's see.
As I'm grossly outnumbered here, can I just come back, and I'm not going to set off again, just take up a point, because there's a fundamental sort of misunderstanding between Ian, myself, certainly, and the others. Just talk about the nature of trade deals, because most levers want us to have our own trade deals
with
other...
I'm just getting a glass.
other... I hadn't provoked you that much yet, I thought. Liam says we're going to have trade deals with America and Australia and New Zealand. It is true that it makes the customs union impossible, because they say, can we stay in the customs union but punch a hole in the external wall we want to? Now, the thing I was going to raise was, you do have to consider, we're not talking about the same thing, I think. What do you understand by a trade deal? Because in my opinion, a trade deal is, say it's just between two countries, it's a mutually binding agreement. You agree a set of tariffs on everything or some goods. You agree the form of customs procedures you're either going to have or not have. You avoid the customs procedures if you have agreement on regulations, on product quality, health and safety, animal welfare, all that kind of thing. Everybody has thousands of these regulations. But when you have an agreement with another government, you both agree, you surrendering part of your sovereignty or pooling your sovereignty, as you do in every agreement, you're going to both bind yourselves to comply with what you've agreed in the agreement. If you get an agreement with Donald Trump, which I don't believe you can, Donald Trump's idea of a trade agreement is one where all his main trading partners export less to the United States, and the United States exports more to the country he wants to sell to. All he wants us to do is take more food stuff from the highly industrialized American agriculture industry, which is very efficient, and produces surpluses. Now, what you have to agree to is obviously the elimination of tariffs, which don't matter much in transatlantic trade now. And then you have to have free access and an agreement on regulations. So the American position will be give up the European regulations on food standards and animal welfare, bind yourself to accept things that comply with our regulations, which are different, in my opinion, lower, but I don't have all the hang-ups about GM crops and so on, which lobbies do. And in the future, neither of us change them without agreement. In fact, they'd be determined by the House of Representatives and the Senate in Congress. And you can't have a trade deal in which you say, oh, we the British are going to decide on goods, the standards of goods, or anything else.
The point you're making is that this
freedom.
The notion of freedom is illusory. That either we abide by the EU rules, or we end up abiding by Uncle Sam's rules, and Trump's rules, or if anything like that.
And the WTO ones are wholly inferior. They're a fallback when you can't get an agreement.
Right.
They're wholly inferior. Big tariffs.
Liam Fox has been off a couple
Trump
of times to America.
Tell
us, does Ken Clark have a point here that America is known for being very robust in its free trade deals? Might we end up having to grant them, I don't know, market access to our NHS while we have to take their chlorinated chicken everybody's so terrified
not
about?
Not if we don't want to. I mean, that's the point. It's a deal. I mean, I want to start by disagreeing about something else, fairly much more fundamental than that. Ken started by saying, well, of course, our position in the world is a function of our membership of the European Union. No, it is not. You know, the Security Council, nothing to do with them. Commonwealth, nothing to do with them. NATO, nothing to do with them. Membership of the G7, because we're the fifth biggest economy in the world. And we ought to get a bit confident about ourselves and realise we're a big, important, influential nation. Second point, just a couple of points of fact. And the great value of the single market and the great value of the rest of the world market. Firstly, the last 15 years... The balance of our trade has gone from being 40-60 in favour of the European Union, that's 60% of our trade is with the European Union, to gone down by about 1% a year towards the rest of the world. So we're now about 55% rest of the world, 45% Europe. Why is that? Ken pulled me up in the House of Commons once, because the rest of the world's growing faster. Absolutely. It's the big market, it's the big place, it's where we want to be aiming our our approaches. Third thing, WTO terms, you know, and the single market as a sort of comparison. In the last, well, actually, up until 1992, from 72 till 92, we did quite well in terms of our exports to the European Union. Pretty well, you know, it actually sort of justified our joining, actually. We did very well. We were beating the Americans in terms of exports to the European Union. Since 92 till now, there are 35 countries outside the European Union whose growth rate of exports to the European Union is better than ours. Mostly on WTO terms, sometimes on free trade agreements, but mostly WTO terms. So from 72 to 92, we did better than America. 92 till now, America did better than us, entirely on WTO terms. So let's not be afraid of trading with the rest of the world the way they trade with us. And we do a deal, we'll do a deal which is mutually advantageous, and we'll both do well out of it. That's what free trade is about. It helps everybody.
Gisela.
There's also a wider point, which in the sense we sort of seem to equate trade deals as being the thing why trade happens. Trade happens because you've just invented a better mousetrap and someone else, the rest of the world wants to buy it. And I think one of the big challenges which we need to start really focusing on and looking ahead is what kind of country are we? Where do we invest? Where's the skills? Where are the new products? The real challenge is, I think, it's a real product of national renewal. One of the things in the last few years where we've made big mistakes, for example, we have continuously, rather than address skills shortages in our own country, when we haven't trained the workforce, we thought you can overcome that by bringing people in from outside and not training your own workforce. It's innovation. It's all those new technologies. That's a chance. And where I also disagree with you, Ken, is the big difference is that at the moment, if you're complying with EU rules, even for your domestic market, you have to comply with those terms. If you're exporting to the United States, then for your export products, you have to comply with the US states, but not for your internal market. So the challenge to look ahead is where's the growth going to come from? You look across at the European Union. It's not the nirvana it was when I first came here. I came here in 1974 doing the three-day week. This country was a basket case. Mainland Europe.
EU membership changed that, Ken, we'll say.
It was the arrival of Giesler.
It was the arrival, of course it was. You know, it was the economic miracle on the continent. And the whole generation who keeps thinking that the future lies within the European Union, just take a new look at it. Take at the election results, look at economic growth. This is not where the future lies. This is the extraordinary opportunity. Now, this is the extraordinary opportunity for national renewal. Have a bit of confidence. The people of the United Kingdom have made rational decisions, and the politicians ought to put that into practice and implement it.
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that everything depends on trade. Obviously, the basics of your economic performance is you've got to be innovative, you've got to be up with the modern economy, you've got to know your markets, you've got to be enterprising, and the British are not very good at that.
We can be pretty good at that.
We're not. There's one reason why we're the slowest growing economy in the G7 at the moment.
Oh, and my God.
The Germans export five times as much to China as we do. They're not held back by the EU. What every major country in the world does, except when we go through waves of nationalism and protectionism, which are very strong in North America, and they're getting stronger in many parts of the world now. Of course, you start by just selling your goods. That's how Captain Cook, traded with his beads with the natives and so on. But you improve your access to markets. You improve your opportunities to stimulate competition for your own people. Improve your performance by wherever you can, removing unnecessary barriers to trade. And there are so many erected. Until the Second World War, they were usual throughout the world. And we steadily have found it's a win-win situation. Both sides enhance their living standards if they just trade directly and compete, keep themselves on their toes. And if we lose every trade agreement in March, And we don't really bother to try and get any more, except on WTO terms, which involve huge tariffs and everything else. We'll be the only developed country in the world that doesn't have a trade agreement with any other country. And most of them are trying to get more trade agreements, which is why about 40 of them have got trade agreements with the European Union, encouraged by the British, because we were keen participants in expanding all those EU deals.
Right, well, we're going to, in a second, go to questions from you British and perhaps audience to see how innovative you can be in your questions here to our panel. But James.
I think sometimes our debate about Brexit can be rather insular in a way. Tonight, we've all taken the assumption that the most important thing about the EU is the single market. I would argue that it isn't anymore. It's now the single currency. And from the moment that the UK decided never to join the single currency, the nature of our relationship with Europe was destined to change, because there are three futures for the single currency, all of which would be bad for the UK. You know, one is that they integrate enough to make their currency work, in which case the Eurozone bloc would dominate the EU and everyone else's interests would get trampled, in which case it would not be good for the UK to be in there. The other is that the Eurozone continues to put kind of sticking plaster solutions in. The Italians and the European Commission have a standoff over the budget, but there's a kind of last minute climb down on one side or the other. And the result of that would be the kind of depressed growth rates that you have seen across the Eurozone as a whole in recent years. Or the third is that the whole thing blows up, in which case you want to be as far away from that as you possibly can be. And I think one of the things that we lose in this debate is that the EU is not static, you know, and that people say, oh, how you made this leap into the unknown when you voted for Brexit. And there's obviously some truth to that. No one knew what the deal was going to be. But it was also true that voting to stay in was another leap into the unknown, because the EU of 10, 20 years' time is going to be very different from the EU of now, in the same way that the EU as it is today is very different from the organisation that Britain voted to join in the first place.
Okay. So let's open this up for questions. I hope one of my colleagues will be wandering around with a microphone, I think. Yep. Okay, I can't quite see from you, so just choose anybody you like the look of. Sir.
Is this working?
Yes, yeah. It is.
Very good. Hello from sunny Leeds. Thank you for the invite. May I ask a question about strong and stable? Is Europe strong and stable? After Mrs. Merkel today, Italy?
That's a very good question. And General Stewart, we've heard today that Angela Merkel has resigned as leader of her party. She's staying on as chancellor. There was once upon a time, I think, Liam, one of the chapters of your book quotes a politician saying that the real trade deal won't be done in Brussels, it'll be done by flying off to Berlin to strike a deal
Have
with
mercy.
The Germans.
Have mercy.
Who was it who said that again? Anyway.
That's not true.
But the point is that we Brits have tended to place a lot of store in there being a strong Germany, who could basically pull the strings and call the EU to heel when we said, look, heaven's sake, we want a trade deal, do it. So, Gisela, can you tell us, what do you think developments in your country of birth mean for Brexit and for the EU? It's difficult to work out who's going to call them to attention if Angela Merkel isn't. It's difficult to see who's going to be the leader of Europe. Doesn't seem to be anybody right now. I guess your point was also whether the EU, as a result, is going to be a lot more fragile because of what's happening in Germany.
And there was I thinking I could have a dig at Theresa May's strong and stable. But let's go on. I mean, James made a very important point about the importance of the single currency. Yeah. I think for the Euro countries who have got a collective interest and will require deeper integration to make the currency work, Germany, whoever is its chancellor, is extremely significant because of its economic and geographic significance. But what has happened in Germany in the last two Länder elections is very interesting. Bavaria, my home state, I mean, for the first 50 years after the war, the question in Bavaria always used to be, by how much will the CSU win? There was never a question of who would win. And suddenly you would find the CSU down to, what was it, 34%, the Greens being the second party. Yesterday in Hessen, what was very interesting was not only the rejection of the two main political parties, but I saw a graph which looked at, and they divided between German voters with an immigration background and German voters without an immigration background, and it showed that their voting patterns were exactly the same. So the AfD got as many votes, the right-wing party, and the Greens got as many votes from those with an immigration background and those not. And what that shows me is that it's a rejection of the main political parties. You look at Italy, south of Rome is a complete domination of Five Star.
Hugely popular at the Porsche now, don't
and, they? And this is why I said at the very beginning, I think we need to be very careful. Democracy, you know, we may take it for granted, but I think it is a by far more fragile creature. And therefore, if you have got big national movements which reject the main political parties, then rather than the politicians, and that's my question to Ken, is, you know, how do we address this fracture? Do we address it by saying, oh, just more of the same? Because that seems to be the answer. Or do we face up to the fact that things have to change? Mm-hmm. And I think the referendum in the United Kingdom was a recognition things have to change, mm-hmm. and we have to grasp it. If we don't, I think we really are threatening democracy.
And that's democracy working, you know. And Ken, you must have thought at that point. Look around Europe. I don't know how many European countries there are who don't have a populist party. And we don't. We don't, I put it to
but
you.
But we're right for one. Because if anybody had a good one, they could storm through.
Like UKIP has just stormed through. As far as I can work out, well, it's UKIP, perished.
UKIP was, as a single issue thing, which appeared to have won and is fragmented and is dysfunctional.
Our democracy is rejuvenating, I think.
If we had a Macron, I think he would. Swept away. He swept away both the French ones. I mean, it's part of the bigger issue.
I agree with Gisela.
Mm. That all the political rules we've been used to until 5 years ago are all off. They don't work anymore. That's why opinion polls don't work anymore and all the rest of it. Because people, a lot of anger and protest is about what we thought was the great normality of the 1990s and all the rest of it. Actually pleased all those who were successful, settled, did well, the aspirational, the educated, and so on. It left a lot of people behind, and the societies of the Western world are full of turmoil, and lots of votes, including the British referendum, were really an angry vote of protest against the establishment, against the rich and successful, against the damn politicians who are unpopular, the political class is unpopular in every Western country. I won't go on because traditional parties, they're strange that ours are only here because there isn't another one, but both our political parties are unpopular. And
the share of the vote being the people, greatest in how many years.
If we had an election soon, people would spin a coin, many of them, as to which one they were going to vote for.
I can see like some of our panel itching to get back in on that.
The Republicans, the Democrats were swept away by Trump. It was the same thing. The aging white working class are disappointed.
Right, Ken, come on.
And the nostalgic...
Let's get some more questions.
Right-wing shires are shattering it. And we haven't worked out a new style of politics recovery.
Right, let us take, look, we've got lots of people asked, let's take two questions. But let's take three and then we'll bundle them out to get through. Right, at the top there, sir, ma'am, sir.
I've asked this question with David Davis before, but I like to aim this at Liam Halligan, being the economist on the panel. We've heard a lot about tariffs, but how is the city going to come out of this in 2, 3, 4 years' time, which is ruled by regulation and not by tariffs? We hear stories about bits of banks going to Dublin or to Paris, or indeed to Shanghai or to America. How is a city going to cope with this in 3 or 4 years' time? Thank you.
Okay. Next question.
Sir, just before I ask my question, I'll stand up. Ken, I'm eligible as a millennial, and the reasons you stated that people voted for Brexit, not one of them came up there. I educated myself before it, and I've done a lot of reading since, mostly ignoring the media, and I've never been persuaded that I've made the wrong decision voting to leave. My question, though, is that in the 2 years, I've had this sinking feeling that the deal is going to be a rotten deal, and when we leave, it will be even worse. I'm not going to ask who could have done a better job, but who, in terms of where we are right now, is there a feeling, and particularly for Mr. Davis there, but the rest of the panel, could someone come in now and do a better job, or has Theresa May been stitched up with the EU such that it doesn't matter who's there, there'll never be a difference?
Can I ask for a quick show of hands? Who else has got a sinking feeling that the deal is going to be a rotten deal? Ooh, I wish I hadn't asked that. Okay. Let's take a third question. If somebody's got a mic, just speak into it quickly. So we've got one in the city, one in the... This man.
Hi, my mic is working.
Okay, sir. Why don't you speak wherever you
are?
Yeah,
a question for Ken. I don't understand how you can be such a big defender of free markets and be so against protectionism, yet at the same token, you find yourself defending the biggest protectionist racket in the world, which is the customs union.
Okay. Liam, on the city.
On the city, well, I think the city can look after itself, frankly. You know, the city was a leading global financial centre a long time before 2007 when passporting was introduced. I mean, look, if there was a single market in services, why do we need passporting? Because there isn't a single market in services, because the single market's deliberately rigged against this country, the services superpower of the world. The city will have a hard time if we have checkers, because then we have no control over the rules, but we have to abide by them. And absurdly, people in France and Germany think Paris and Frankfurt could actually challenge the city of London. They still hold a candle for that, even though I think Frankfurt, when I last looked, was 25th financial center in the world, and Paris was 34. They're interesting places, but they're not the city of London.
Which is ranks what?
Well, number one in some
definitions,
and number two in most others. We're not the slowest growing economy in the G7, ladies and gentlemen, and we haven't been since 2016. I know you keep hearing that on the television and the radio, but 30 seconds, an open mind and a Google browser will show you that that's not true. In 2016, we outgrew the US, France and Germany. In 2017, we outgrew Italy and Japan. They were in the G7 the last time I looked, Ken. In 2018, we had a slow start, but I said in my Telegraph column last week, I think on current figures, if you look at the granular data and the survey data, we're currently outgrowing France and Germany. I think we may for the year as a whole. And I must echo what James Forsyth has said on the euro. You know, Joe Stiglitz is a Nobel laureate economist. He's an absolute pin-up for the Democrats in the US and for Guardian readers here in the UK. Joe Stiglitz wrote a book that concluded the euro is possibly the most disastrous economic policy ever devised by man. And yet an economically illiterate commission is so determined to challenge the America's reserve currency status, that they're determined to press ahead. You now have parts of Italy that are poorer than Poland. That's why you have massive upsurge in populist politicians. And I must say one thing on trade deals. The EU is really bad at conducting trade deals. It hasn't secured a trade deal with the US despite 60 years of trying. It hasn't secured a trade deal with China. There aren't 40 trade agreements, Ken, between the EU and the rest of the world. Ratified, there are 26. And the vast majority of them are with tiny countries. Tiny countries. Look it up. Do some research and you'll see. And the EU is really bad at conducting trade deals because it's 27-dimension chess. It's much better if you're a big economy to conduct trade deals unilaterally. Even the South Koreans and the Swiss, even the Chileans have managed to secure trade deals that cover an area of the world that's three times bigger than the area of the world that the EU's trade deals cover, ladies and gentlemen. So I think we can do much better negotiating trade deals on our own. And Our trade with America is already our biggest single country trading partner, is much bigger than Donald Trump. Donald Trump talks a good game, and of course, he will drive a hard bargain, but we can drive a hard bargain too. And if we don't like the trade deal he offers, we'll wait for the next president and then we'll sign one.
David Davis, can I ask why you, I presume you don't have the sinking feeling that we're going to get a rotten deal? You seem to be incredibly optimistic about this. I mean, we can't see a good deal right now, but you basically reckon that in the same way that, you know, when you see an MP trying to sit down in a packed bench, he aims his bottom at a non-existent space, then miraculously a space appears. I'm sure Ken's had this experience. You seem to think that the EU...
He's describing the experience of Liz Truss in the budget today, actually.
But you seem to think that in the last minute, miraculously, a good deal is going to appear where there are no signs of one right now. So what on earth makes you so optimistic?
Well, I mean, two things. I mean, as I said at the beginning, I mean, the pressure... Look, the European Union never, ever makes a deal before the last possible day. First thing, you know, actually it's normally the last minute of the last hour of the last possible day, and sometimes they do something called in Brussels stopping the clock, so that the last minute may be a day or two later. So that's the first thing to understand. And this last bit was always going to be a high-stress panic time. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, you know, we have got many more cards than we persuade ourselves that we have to play. Many more cards, you know. Don't just take my name, my view of it. The head of, I think, Deutsche Bank last week said Britain will be fine. It's got an entrepreneurial population and it's got a floating pound. Those two things will make everything come right. You know, so from everybody's point of view, and the Germans suddenly, the BDI, which is the German CBI, which is normally completely obedient to the German government, 2 weeks ago suddenly said you must stop there being a no deal to Merkel. All of a sudden, they suddenly came out. Why? Because Bavaria, your homelander, will lose one-third of its car sales and two-thirds of its dairy sales in the event of no deal. So there's lots and lots of pressure on both sides. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, what do we look for? I mean, Chequers is a disaster. Now, let's be clear about this. And it's not a disaster because of the existing industries, chemicals, cars, whatever they may be. It's a disaster because we are world leaders in life sciences, genetics, artificial intelligence, and so on. We're world leaders at the moment. In 5 years' time, if we've been taking European rules on areas where we're world leaders, we will cease to be world leaders. Why? Because they'll write the rules to make sure that's what happens. That's how a protectionist operation behaves. And Liam is right. They are a protectionist operation. You should really have James Dyson on this panel to tell you quite how they do that sort of thing. So we will get to a good deal. Now, actually, what's going on, it's interesting watching what's going on in Cabinet. I'm outside now, so I can now talk about it. But for the last 8 weeks, you may not have noticed, but I've been trying to run a campaign to persuade them of what the alternatives are. The alternative is very simple. It's a free trade deal based on Canada, but taking bits out of Korea and so on. Easy to do, actually, if you write it
down.
And
on offer.
And on offer, because Barnier and Juncker and all of the others have said it's on offer.
But not for Northern Ireland.
Well, that's another whole meeting, but Northern Ireland is soluble, as Liam himself said. Indeed, David Trimble went to Brussels last week and told them, Trimble, you know, of all the people, you know, we give credit to Blair, we give credit to John Major. The person who deserves most credit...
And won the Nobel Prize.
And won the Nobel Prize for it is David Trimble. Mm. And he says the problem is non-existent, almost those terms. So let's not get ourselves distracted on that. But come back to the cabinet. All of a sudden, the last couple of weeks, we're seeing Penny Mordaunt, we're seeing, very importantly, Geoffrey Cox, the Attorney General, saying, you cannot do this. This is what this means. This will be a problem. And they're beginning to see that they have to come up with something other than Chequers. And as the pressure goes up, that's exactly what will happen.
Okay. And Ken, you were asked a question as to why you don't recognise the protectionist elements of the EU. I mean, you don't have to go as far as to say it's a protectionist scam, but surely you see, look at the tariffs that they impose to anybody who threatens Italian leather manufacturers, and you know, the things that which we in this country do not have an interest in increasing the prices of things
agreeing,
that we do.
We've been agreeing them for the last 48 years. I mean, firstly, just briefly on the city, the idea that the city is going to collapse is all nonsense, of course. It's a global financial centre.
You're coming round to what you're thinking now, Ken.
No, I've always said that. No. But you're going to lose important parts of the business. The passporting, which allows us to deal with the euro-denominated securities and huge markets in euro clearance and things we've established, we went as plaintiffs to the European Court of Justice to challenge the European Central Bank, which wanted to exclude us because we weren't joining the euro. We've never lost a case that matters in the European Court of Justice. We've always had a very good British judge sitting on the international panel. Well, we have.
You lost my case.
And we went there and we established the passport and we've given up the passport. We won't have it. And so it's part of the business of the banks and so on that is actually going to leave. And that they're either going to Dublin or they're going to Paris, Frankfurt, Amsterdam, or whatever. Quite a few loss of jobs, but with any luck, you know, the rest we provide services to the world. But it's still a blow to our economy. It will actually, you know, be a significant loss of business. Both sides exaggerate normally, but let's not exaggerate. But it is damaging to financial services, which is the most important and successful part of the British economy at the moment. Okay. Now, I don't understand this protectionist thing. I mean, there's a fervent atmosphere in this room, and somehow we're fighting our enemies, that all these Europeans, the Germans and so on, they're wicked opponents. They've been enslaving us in this for some time.
There's not a distinction.
It's a union of nation states, 28 nation states. They are mainly our closest friends in the world. And the Americans, we have a different kind of relationship with. Of course, they don't want a bad deal. They don't want no deal. All this that they're plotting to do us down, it's all comic, tragic, really. The fact is they have the same interest as us. What they won't agree is that we actually suddenly decide we want to keep all the advantages we've had for 45 years of the customs union, the single market, particularly the single market, because the British were the leading country in creating the single market. The harmonisation of regulations, which was key to it, was advocated by the Thatcher government, and the first commissioner who started producing thousands of the things was the commissioner appointed by Margaret. So all this, somehow it's all designed, the 27 others, through the agency of their wicked civil servants in Brussels, are trying to be protectionist against the British. This is paranoia. It's a conspiracy theory.
Ken, I'm not going to let you get away with that.
What you can't have is all the advantages to say we're taking none of the obligation.
Two quotes. One, Britain must be seen to pay a price for leaving the European Union. Michel Barnier, right? Second quote, you must be seen to lose. Angela Merkel. Now, these are our friends, right? Now, I understand why. I understand why. It's because they view Brexit, well, firstly, they want to preserve the Union and don't want us to leave anybody else to leave. But they view Brexit as a populist uprising. That's what they view it as. And this populist uprising categorization of Trump and of Brexit and of what's happening in Italy and what's happening in Greece and so on, you know, actually, the people have a point. In 2008, the entire world financial and political establishment let them down with the huge financial crisis. And then the aftershocks in the Eurozone, the European establishment let them down. I don't know how else you would describe Greece, frankly. And in the future, in the near future, they're going to let them down in Italy too. So I'm afraid if the way you cope with, quotes, populism is to try and make the penalty greater, you make populism worse, you make politics more problematic, and you undermine democracy. And I think we've got to take that seriously, Ken, and we've got to face it head on. Because otherwise we'll face a real problem.
Okay, let's take three more questions, if Ken Clark will let us. Do you think he's going to let us?
The point they're making...
Maybe not.
Don't start saying you don't want to listen to people you disagree with now. The point they're making is if the British take all the obligations, but take all the advantages they want, the selected ones, but won't acknowledge any of the obligations anymore, so we're not going to pay anymore towards the costs of any of this or towards the development of the roads. We just want all the bits we like, but we're not going to be tied in any way to necessarily obeying the regulations or paying a financial contribution.
That's why you leave. Europe
is absolutely full of right-wing nationalists, left-wing populist movements who will all say, well, why don't we have the same? Why can't Hungary have just the advantages but none of the obligations and so on? And that's why I agree that Chequers is a dog's breakfast, but I thought Chequers, if we all pretended it was a good start for proper negotiations, we could get on some serious negotiations, because I keep saying all trade deals, and we as a trading nation do need trade deals. Don't believe all this rubbish about, oh, it doesn't matter, with no real disadvantages of not having any with anybody. If you're going to trade deals, it is a combination of things which are to the advantage of the other party, which you concede to them, so they can see something that's very important to you, and it's mutually binding either recognition of regulations or harmonized regulations. That is how the world works, and it isn't a wicked foreign conspiracy against us demand these things. I haven't time to take up the EU negotiating trade deals. The idea they're not very good at it and all that. I was involved in the US TTIP negotiations. I led for the cabinet my last job in working with Brussels and going to Washington, because the British were the ones who were the keenest advocates of that. Obama, we couldn't get a deal. It wasn't a European problem. The problem was what we wanted, all Europeans, certainly ourselves, the French, the Germans, was in exchange for opening up our markets, would they open up public procurement? Would they open up their services, particularly financial services? That's what our aims were. Right. And it's hopeless. The Obama people, Congress is so protectionist, right, so full of lobbies, you couldn't get anything.
Let's get three questions, and we'll keep our replies quick so we get more when we can. Right, okay. Ma'am.
In brief, my small experience of business negotiation is that when there is any asymmetry between the partners, the larger partner won't take the smaller partner seriously until they have felt some real commitment to a willingness to do no deal. So my question is, I wonder if any of the panel share my conviction that the way to a good deal for Britain lies through no deal first.
Let's take two more. Sir,
hello?
Over there. Yeah, ma'am. Yeah.
Thank you. So I have a question for Mr. Ken Clark. At the beginning of the...
No. Ken will answer it quickly, I promise.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Okay, wasn't I supposed to ask him? Okay, so at the beginning you said, you know, it wasn't very clear from the campaign that leaving a Brexit necessarily imply leaving single market or European Court of Justice. You mentioned your debate with Mr. Dan Hannan. But survey after survey, opinion poll after opinion poll, when people were asked why they wanted to leave the European Union, they gave two answers and they were quite consistent. One of them was that they didn't want EU to have any role in British lawmaking, which I think implies leaving the jurisdiction of European Court of Justice, and the second was immigration and having controls, which implies leaving single market. So it's not very clear to me why consistently you say that it wasn't clear what Brexit meant and what it's supposed to be. When there's actually quite consistent answer with the surveys. Thank you.
Okay, and let's take a third question. Oh, somebody, yes, sir, you're about to explode if you don't ask it, so yes.
Is that?
Oh, this is Premier.
Yes,
lovely
hello.
To see you.
This is a question for David Davis, I think, but it'll be for you to decide. Is it not the case that we've ended up with a Chequers dog's breakfast precisely because we have let Brussels and Dublin weaponize the Irish border issue? And my question to David Davis is, how in the hell did we allow that to happen?
Right. Thanks. For those of you who didn't know, Sir Christopher was our former ambassador to the US. That's the company you're in here tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Asking a question mainly about diplomacy, really, and a bad diplomacy. David Davis, how did we end up in such a terrible diplomatic position where we're getting beaten up?
I can answer all three questions at the same time, actually, because they're the same question. Number one, the first lady who spoke said that no deal is what allows you to make a deal. Of course, any deal where you are unwilling or unable to walk away is going to be a bad deal. Indeed, it's going to be a deal entirely on the terms of the other side. Now, this is particularly important with respect to Ireland, because the country in all of Europe, including ourselves, that will lose most by no deal is Ireland. Devastatingly badly by no deal. The agricultural sector will be destroyed in the event of no deal with all the tariffs that go there, and every other part of its industrial sector will be very, very badly damaged. But we sort of walked away from no deal. So in that respect, Christopher is right. I'm glad to see you looking healthy as well, Christopher.
Yeah.
in terms, I mean, you heard half of it from Liam. Initially, when Enda Kenny was Taoiseach, we were having discussions and negotiations going on between the customs personnel on each side. And at that time, both John Thompson in the UK and I've forgotten his name.
Niall Cody
in Dublin, the head of the Irish customs operation, each said, we don't need a hard border. We can deal with this through existing, not future technology, existing approaches. And that's the truth of it. What happened was that Varadkar decided to politicize it, and bluntly, number 10 went along with it. And that's where we ended up with the full alignment language. You may remember the language, that we will accept that Northern Ireland will be in full alignment, regulatory alignment, with the South. I had a conversation with the Prime Minister. I suggested that this sounded like harmonization, and it perhaps wasn't what we wanted to do. And she said, no, it's full alignment of outcomes. And my commentary at the time was, well, are you sure the other side understand that? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, from the Balfour Declaration onwards, when the same language is read to mean different things on each side of the negotiating table, it leads to trouble. And that's exactly where we are now.
James, can you say a bit about the importance of what David Davis just said there, the misunderstanding about what was agreed in December, and how this has changed the situation now, where the Cabinet don't listen to Theresa May anymore because they believe she'll get the wrong end of the stick, as she did in December, and instead we're looking to the Attorney General?
Yes.
Some of them are.
The Cabinet feel, the Brexiteers in the Cabinet feel deeply misled about what was agreed in December. Now, the problem with what was agreed in December wasn't necessarily what was agreed in December, but the fact that the UK government didn't make any effort to put its understanding of what was agreed into a legal text. Mm. And the failure to do that meant that if you write the legal text, you say what was agreed. So the EU wrote the legal text, and the EU have therefore decided essentially what was agreed. And I think this is a problem because Michael Gove said in Cabinet, in terms, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. And said, I'm not signing anything off until I've seen clear, written legal advice. I mean, this is quite extraordinary. And then several other cabinet ministers piled in behind saying they want the same. This is amazing. This is a cabinet saying to the Prime Minister, no, I'm not going to take your word for it. I want to see the legal advice. And then I think we come to this point about no deal, which is there is a great paradox at the moment, which is the thing that is making no deal most likely is the UK's failure to prepare for no deal. Because in a negotiation, weakness is provocative. The EU look at us and they think we're in no state to walk away. We're not doing anything to persuade them that we're serious about no-deal planning. Today's budget was a classic example. That was a moment that Philip Hammond could have flashed some ankle about some of the things we might have done in the event of no-deal that might have made the EU think, we actually don't want some kind of Singapore West economy 26 miles off our coastline, so maybe let's be a little bit more flexible in the negotiation. But the danger is that because at nearly every point in this process, when push has come to shove, the EU is back down, the EU thinks this will carry on happening. And the danger is you get accidental no deal. The EU thinks that the UK can stomach something on Northern Ireland, but Theresa May can't, not only because she's a stauncher unionist than most, but also because of her political position vis-a-vis the DUP. And we end up stumbling into no deal by accident. And this is the great tragedy, which is by failing to prepare for no deal, we have made it dangerously lightly.
Right. We haven't got much time left, so let's take another three questions. What are we going to do? Okay, if you see a mic, grab it, start to speak. Sir.
Okay, I've just spent 30 years wandering around the corridors of Brussels and Strasbourg, and the only thing I would say, you have to watch your back at all times when you're in negotiation with any Commission officials. Please, all of you, read the Tony Abbott article that's in The Spectator today. It sums up the Gazella's point of view that we should be confident of what we're going to do. Now, the question is this. I have not yet seen a free trade agreement that anybody's come forward with to present to the Commission or the negotiators. Why have we not done that? We could be confident, robust, determined, aggressive if necessary. And by doing that and putting forward a free trade agreement specific to our advantage, we might get some result.
Yeah. One over there, sir.
Ken keeps referring to this question of benefiting from the single market. In the last 17 years, our deficit with the EU has grown by 57 billion. Our surplus with the rest of the world, principally on WTO terms, has grown by 52 billion. Now, Ken, you know that deficits reduce our GDP and surpluses increase it. The facts of the matter is there haven't been any benefits from being members of the single market. We have lost out from it, and we've done much better with the rest of the world.
The final
idea that you only trade with countries so long as you have a surplus with them is believed in by Donald Trump and was believed many years ago by a fringe group of economists called Mercantilists. The deficit or surplus at any given time is no measure of the benefits of a trade deal. It is a good indication of your comparative competitiveness and how you should set about trying to remedy it.
Okay, sir, quickly.
As a teacher, I was very disappointed with the funding for schools in today's budget. I'm wondering what you think the impact of Brexit will be on schools and perhaps also universities.
Okay. David Davis, do you want to take the first point there as to why we have not put forward a free trade agreement and negotiated it? Because you were the chap who could have taken the option.
That was the white paper that was never published, the one in June. That was precisely what it was. It was aimed at a free trade deal based entirely on European precedents, namely Canada, but not just Canada, also South Korea, because South Korean cars can be exported here without being re-inspected because they've got a mutual recognition agreement. Based on New Zealand, because their agricultural arrangements are better than others are, inspection, and so on. So it exists. It is just that the Prime Minister decided to go a different way. She went with Chequers instead. While we're on them, can I deal with the other two as well? Because they're both important. Single market. I mean, whoever said it. I mean, there's one thing that people, economists in the future, will look back in the 90s, and there were two big things that happened. One was very important, and one was important but less so. The less so was the single market. The really important thing was the Uruguay round and the liberalisation of free trade across the world, when tariffs came down enormously. And there was a huge increase in global trade. to our benefit in the rest of the world, to the extent. Now, that's why WTO is not so worrying today. If we'd been doing this in 1990, there'd be huge tariff barriers everywhere. So you're right in that respect. The other thing, which nobody sort of said, or Ken sort of alluded to it, is our deal we're going to strike with the world, broadly speaking, is you sell us your goods, we'll sell you our services. Now, it's a massive simplification, but we're an 80% plus service economy. From the European Union has not got a single market in services. So, you know, this is not a terrific advantage to us. They only take the city product, because the city product is the best in the world, because we've got a critical mass of skills here. So, bear in mind when you're looking at all the figures and all the numbers, the biggest thing that happened in the 90s wasn't a single market, it was a Uruguay round. And the last point I'll pick up on universities is important. Right at the beginning of this process, there was a terror that we wouldn't take European students, that we wouldn't allow the movement of European researchers and so on. I actually had the universities come to see me. And the Treasury moved to guarantee future grants, for example, in what for them is record time. 1 month in August, they made a decision. You know? The Treasury's never done anything in 1 month, let alone in August, you know. So the simple truth is that everybody's incredibly focused on making sure that we stay within the same research arrangements, that we stay with the same exchange arrangements as much as we can. We are one of the leading intellectual economies in the world. One of the requirements of an intellectual economy is the free movement of ideas, and with that, the free movement of highly skilled people. And that will continue. The issue on free movement's not about research associates and professors, or indeed about students. It's about other things. And we will not give up one of our greatest advantages in the pursuit of Brexit.
Final word, Gisela.
Yeah, very quickly. Can I come back to Christopher Mayer's point about Northern Ireland, which I think is really, really important? Because we've got a position where the European Commission and the Taoiseach have said if there's no deal, they're not going to put up any hard borders,
right,
which is the key thing. So if they can agree on no hard border without a deal, could someone please explain to me? And that leads me to the greatest danger, actually, it's not so much checkers. I think it's a backstop agreement which has no exit clause, which will lock us into something which will be irrevocable.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we promised we'd let you go at 8:30. Now, if anybody has not got a subscription to the world's greatest magazine, I've got some good news for you. We can offer you a month free, so you can there are forms you can fill them in, you get a month free, see what you're missing. To the rest of you, in fact, to all of you, thank you so much for coming, and please join me in thanking our panel.